Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome back to Footprints. In 2019, Bath and North East Somerset Council declared a climate emergency, and it's aiming for carbon neutrality, or net zero, by 2030. In this episode, we'll explore what that means and what some of the challenges are facing the city. What will Bath and the landscape surrounding it look like if it's to be powered by solar and wind farms? How can this be achieved while making sure it keeps its World Heritage status? Could areas in Bath and the villages surrounding it one day be powered entirely by local renewable energy sources? In answer to these questions, we'll hear about some of the projects and ideas the council are developing from Robin Spalding. And an architect, Funda Kamal, will tell us about her animation video, which visualises a future net zero Bath adapted to climate change. But let's start up on Kelston Roundhill at the Old Barn. It's a building used for weddings, memorials and events, and it's completely off-grid. Recently, they've installed a new zero-emission system to provide electricity and hot water. I met up with William Heath to hear all about it.
Hi there, how are you?
Hi, William.
Okay. Welcome.
We're on Kelston Roundhill. I'm William. I purchased this in a partnership 12 years ago. So it's a 160-acre farm site with the iconic trees, the Kelston Tump, which we all see from miles away as we come back to Bath, and also a barn, which we refurbished for general events and use, so you can have memorials or away days here.
It's a very, very beautiful part of the world, and Kelston Tump is a favourite, very heartfelt place, I think, for many people, isn't it?
Yeah, people love it, and also, it means all sorts of things to all sorts of people. It's remembered in, you know, folk songs and art. It crops up in engravings of Bath, you know, from 250 years ago. So it's visually iconic and a place that people love.
And right now it's very mysterious because it's sort of in the mist, isn't it, just above your beautiful barn.
We're sitting in a cloud, it's true. You can barely see it. Yeah, it's nice. It's nice in all weathers. I mean, you get fearsome wind and rain up here, and then beautiful sunny weather and clear days when you can see right into Wales and right back to the Marlborough Downs. Yeah, it's lovely.
Fantastic. Now, you're going to show me a little bit around the barn, but we're here really to think about how you have decarbonised it in terms of energy. Is that right?
Yeah, it's you want to be light touch here. We're off grid. It's wholly uneconomic to connect to the grid, even if you could do it in any kind of realistic time scale. So we're off grid. So if people come up here, either they don't have any energy or they need to find some way. We used a diesel generator for some years. It it breaks your heart a little bit each time you switch it on, and you have to sort of keep it topped up and maintained. So we have done a shift to renewables, which I can show you. We can have a look inside the barn and you can see what we've just done. You'll be the first visitor to see...
Sorry to let you in through the most convenient way. So you are the first visitor to witness. What we've done here is we left the floor a little low deliberately, and it's just been raised 4 inches, and it's now plumbed with underfloor heating. So we've got underfloor heating pipes going through this concrete, and I'll show you the renewables, which are hybrid photovoltaic thermal panels, so they pick up heat as well as electricity. And, you know, in the event there's no sunlight at all, we have a backup boiler. We still have a backup diesel generator for electricity. So hopefully this will be significantly cozier in the spring and in the autumn. We've still got 2 log burners. Regrettably, there's a very abundant supply of ash coming through, you know, because of the ash dieback. So you can be warm and toasty here for your company away days or your Christmas holidays.
It's fantastic. Look at that beautiful flat floor.
Yeah, it's a nice screed, properly laid. We're going to paint it, but I haven't decided exactly what colour yet, but something simple. So, and then underneath it is a beautiful lattice work of water pipes for underfloor heating.
And that's linked to both renewable source and a diesel generator?
Yeah, I'll show you.
Okay, I've got it. Right, let's go out.
there is a phenomenal amount of wind up here. It just barrels in off the ocean, hits here.
Given there's so much wind up here, would you consider a wind turbine?
We trialled a wind array. It was superb. We trialled a wind array by a small company called Spinetic. And, you know, the results were very positive. The planning regime is very hostile to wind. I don't know how quickly that's going to change or adjust, but it could have been written by BP or Shell, frankly, the sort of national planning policy on wind. It would absolutely make sense to have small-scale wind generation up here. It's an area of outstanding natural beauty. It's in the Green Belt. So, you know, the aesthetics have to be considered, obviously.
And it's not, I guess it's part of the World Heritage Site. Is it here or are we outside that?
We're outside it, but clearly part of the skyline. I mean, if you think of, you know, you're thinking of the Bathscape, Kelston Roundhill is clearly part of the Bathscape. You know, you can see Bath from the top, you can see Kelston Roundhill from much of Bath and much of Bristol for that matter.
So how would you feel about wind turbines on the hills?
Oh, I'd feel absolutely positive about it. I mean, I think you'd want to be sensitive about where you locate it. And also, I favoured a vertical spindle wind array, which has a 6 metre height, over the sort of propeller type, you know, much higher ones. And they're very efficient at low wind speeds as well. So we could absolutely, you know, generate sufficient electricity for activities here with a vertical spindle wind array. Regrettably, Spinetic, you know, like many startups, didn't survive. So we would be, you know, looking around for a way to supplement the photovoltaic thermal panels with wind, which is obviously much more abundant in the winter.
How much would it generate? Would it generate just enough for this, for your activities, or would it be able to spread to sort of neighbouring dwellings?
That's a really good question. I mean, the modest aim is that you have something like a 5 kilowatt array, which means that you can do events here without ever plugging into anything. The more ambitious aim would be that Kelston, as a village of 100 people to the northwest of Bath, becomes a significant community energy resource for the community of Bath. And you know, you could do solar at scale and you could do wind at scale here. And Bath and West Community Energy, who are really, really good at planning and implementing these sorts of things, they make it very clear that larger projects are where it's at in terms of getting a return on investment from a community project. I think, you know, if the village wanted to go down the route of backing a more ambitious energy project, then I think that would be superb. And I would absolutely be interested in doing that. And certainly, you know, the very successful Park Farm Bathsoft cheese business, you know, they're running a substantial business. They have energy needs and they've got energy potential. So some sort of collaboration like that, I think, would be really good. But initially, the concern is just to sort out the needs of the barn and the occasional, you know, events and weddings and away days that happen here. So for that, something like 5 kilowatts would be absolutely adequate.
And of course, the cheese company is just below you, isn't it?
They're just below. They're the tenants. They actually farm all the land below the Roundhill field itself. So their cows graze on this land and make that fantastic, you know, award-winning cheese, which we all love. This is the photovoltaic thermal array. So you can see a dozen hybrid panels, photovoltaic thermal panels, sort of classic black glass with silver lines running down them. They take electricity from sunlight, but they also have a heat exchanger behind them. So they pick up heat for hot water. So they're mounted sloping onto a container, which we're about to open up and go in. And there you'll see how it all works.
Oh, I've never seen anything like this before. But then, I don't think I've ever been up close to a solar panel display.
So these are Spanish designed and built. It's a company called Arbora, based in Zaragoza. The founder came here for the launch event of this. And he's a lovely professor from the university there, very passionate guy. He's got a very successful company coming along. And the installation was done by Paul Brimble and his company BEE, based in Trowbridge. So they're very meticulous heating and renewable engineers.
We're coming into what from the outside looks like a shipping container almost.
So they built in their car park, they've built this shipping container and they've installed in it batteries, inverter, backup LPG boiler. That is a heat store. So that large tank there keeps 1,000 litres of hot water, which comes out of the heat exchangers. And then that's the cold water input.
Wow. And everything is lagged.
It's beautifully done. It's really, they've done a lovely job, yeah.
And it's the size of the voltaic cells, so it doesn't really take up any... You wouldn't even know it was here, in fact, from the barn itself. You can't see it behind the cells, can you? It's very neatly hidden.
I hope it's got a nice footprint. I mean, no complaints so far. And also, in a way, it's curiously consistent with the design of the barn. I mean, the slope and the colour, they echo the roof of the barn.
So what do you think it will look like being in and around Bath in 20 years, William?
Well, I'd like to think that the Georgian buildings have got solar panels on the roof and underfloor heating. I would like to think we're all using renewables. I think the placing of things like wind energy is, it's very sensitive. And I think people who feel a fundamental objection to that transition will hate the sight of them. And people who feel the transition is terribly important, you know, will like them and put up with the difference. I mean, I think they're certainly arguably more attractive than pylons, but, you know. So Bath in 20 years' time, I mean, I'd love to think that we've pioneered the transition to energy-efficient heritage buildings. They're very challenging. I think the Bath Preservation Trust are completely on the case about this. They really understand. I mean, they did that groundbreaking report, Warmer Bath, 10 years ago, didn't they? And I think you know, the present management and leadership of the Bath Preservation Trust totally understand why this transition has to be done. In another role, away from the Kelston Roundhill, I'm one of the trustees of Fairfield House, Bath, the Haile Selassie House. That's a 9-bedroom, 23-room building which hasn't been maintained for 30 years. So from an energy point of view, it's delinquent. I mean, it's terrible. Have you ever seen a EPC which says 999 on it? Because, you know, it really is unclassified.
EPC?
Energy Performance Certificate. So the things you have to do when you buy and sell a house. And, you know, essentially, a good one is 100 or less and a bad one is 300. And Fairfield House is terrible. And I think I'd like to see it go through a transition from being the worst performing heritage building in the city to an exemplar, because it's not of huge architectural interest, but it's of immense historic and cultural importance. So just like at the assembly rooms, I think they're doing great work, you know, to take it to a far more environmentally friendly setup. We would like to do the same at Fairfield House. But that's a very different case. I mean, that's, you know, it's in the city, it's connected to gas, it's connected to the grid, it's overgrown by trees. Here at Kelston Roundhill, we're in a barn which is, you know, huge amounts of sunlight come down, huge amounts of wind come across, and its own energy needs are very modest because it's just used for occasional events.
Thank you so much, William, for showing me round and showing me what you've been doing and telling us about your vision for the future.
That's a pleasure. Happy editing, and look forward to hearing it. All right.
That was William Heath up on Kelston Roundhill. Now let's meet Funda Kamal. She's an architect and climate activist, and here she is talking about her work and about her animation video showing how Bath might look in a net zero future, set up to adapt to climate change.
My name's Funda Kemal. I'm an architect. I moved to Bath about 21 years ago to finish my qualifications at FCB Studios here in the Bath Brewery in Bath Easton. And I was there for a few years and moved a bit of a change in direction to work at the council, Bath and North East Somerset Council, for 15 years after that as their senior urban designer in planning. And I spent the last 3 years of that in the conservation team. I absolutely loved that work. And it was a way of really getting to know the place and getting I suppose, under the skin of it, my sort of design philosophy and architectural approach is that you need to know and understand a place to be able to understand what the right decisions will be, particularly for projects that are to do with regeneration of a place. And so that's my area of expertise. I work producing ideas, consultations, and work that is to do with regenerative architecture. I've always been a climate activist and always incorporated planet-friendly lifestyles and designs into my work and into my own life. I produced a little video that was talking about the fact that the city of Bath particularly is a World Heritage City and that it has these very special qualities that make it worthy of that kind of global designation. It's a city set in its landscape setting. Everywhere you look, there is a little glimpse or access physically or visually to the countryside. So it's a very, very special place. But at the same time, the historic nature of the city to be preserved and to be protected and to sort of endure for further generations needs to also be able to work in a climate friendly future. So we know that global temperatures are increasing. We know that that will have an impact on our cities. We know that Bath is going to get hotter. We know it's going to experience more extreme weather. So that will be storms, additional rainfall, more susceptibility to flooding, and that there are vulnerabilities in our historic city because of that. We already have flood protection measures. They may or may not take us into the next 50 or 100 years. And we need to be mindful that the planet is changing at quite a rapid rate now. So the little video I made was about what would the city look like if it went into a future where it not only adapted to the temperature increases that we're already going to experience and are experiencing, but if it also tried to proactively prevent further harm and further greenhouse gases. So I did a little animation, just very simple animations showing what would happen if the city centre and those surrounding areas were covered in green walls when they're for their south-facing elevations. This would not only create cooling for those buildings and a little bit more protection from the extreme weather, but also increase biodiversity, increase the sort of appearance and feel of the city as a welcoming place for biodiversity and humans. So that was one of the ideas. Another was rethinking different elements of the city infrastructure, like reducing the width of roads and increasing green areas, making sure that the more hostile junctions and things that we've got, like I showed the example of Churchill Gyratory, which is a sort of a massive extreme roundabout that goes around a scheduled ancient monument in a World Heritage City, which for me has always been a disappointing proposal, really. So I show that being greened up and having people being able to walk through it, traffic being minimised. I show what trams might look like going up major A roads. I show the A367, for example, and then I show wind turbines on some of our hillsides, and I show them to scale. So this video just shows that actually not only are these technologies reversible, I also put solar panels on every south-facing roof. They are reversible, but they are also very minimal impact and also not as harmful as you might think. There's already a lot of visibility of the roofs and of the hillsides from the city centre. And it's not necessarily that adding these new technologies, these reversible technologies, will be of detriment to the city. So it was a little experiment to see, well, what would it look like? Would it really be harmful? And so the video is asking that question. Do you think that these new technologies and these new approaches to architecture, biophilic design is what the buzzword is at the moment, where elements from nature or nature-led design is going, it's sort of being pushed forward. Are these harmful or are these beneficial? And are these more beneficial than they are harmful? Just those kinds of questions where perhaps I don't know the answers, perhaps you don't know the answers, but they are questions we need to ask and conversations we need to be having. A comparison I make in the video is of the other paraphernalia that we've already got in the countryside, like huge pylons that are all related to the fossil fuel industry. So there is a balance to be struck, I think, between sort of understanding that the countryside, in terms of energy, has always been functional, or it has been functional since industrialisation, for sure. And that there is a sort of way that we can go into a future that, yes, uses large structures, but that they can be as recessive as we've got used to the fossil fuel infrastructure being. That's my opinion anyway. But I think the importance of the visualizations is to just be able to have these imaginings, but in a sort of informed way, so that when you're thinking about these debates or having these conversations, you can look at it and think, okay, so I know for a fact that from this viewpoint, this is the Alexandra Park viewpoint that I take, I will be able to see all of these solar panels on the south-facing roofs. I know probably from Sham Castle, I won't be able to see them. Possibly from Bath City Farm, I'll be able to see them. Almost certainly not from the northern slopes, from Lansdowne and from Camden. So then you can start to have these more informed discussions that are really local, that are really to do with the place. And it's this that I'm most interested in sort of pushing in the architectural agenda, is this real understanding of the place and people and what's important and why, before you make any intervention, understand first, communicate first. So that's what the video is about.
Thanks so much there to Funda Kamal, and you can find links to her animation video in the programme notes. Now, in order to reach net zero, Bath and North East Somerset Council need to meet the energy demand through renewable sources, wind, solar, hydro. And this includes making all their public and office buildings and transport carbon neutral. So where is this energy going to come from? While more and more renewable energy is coming through the national grid, there is a growing need to generate local energy, and commercial and community energy schemes are increasing. To try and make sense of all of this, I met up with Robin Spalding, who is the Renewable Energy Programme Manager for the Council. And I started by asking Robin about the different merits of solar and wind.
So solar obviously is very seasonal. It's very good in the summer. In theory, it's a good match for something like, filling your house battery, for example, on a domestic setting and charging your car with that overnight, or filling your car during the day. But usually the capacity factor is one thing we talk about when we talk about renewable energy, and that's the proportion of the time that that energy source is actually, providing energy. With wind, it's about 30% of the time on average. With solar, it's less. It's 10% of the time. So your priority really should be wind, because through the winter, when you need your heat pumps working, and obviously they use electricity, they're very energy efficient, but the cost of electricity means that in some cases they might be more expensive to run as it stands at the moment. So having wind as a source of electricity, and obviously nationally we've got a good start on that. We've got a good level of wind, so running heat pumps in the winter can be very low carbon. But wind is much better through the winter.
And so that brings us on to why Bath is unique as a World Heritage site. So it's not the same as somewhere like neighbouring Bristol. How does having, say, a wind farm on the top of Lansdowne or on the top of Salisbury Hill or any of the hills surrounding Bath, how does that fit in with the UNESCO World Heritage status.
Yeah, it's challenging, because, and the way our planning policy is set up at the moment, it's landscape-led. So it'd be unlikely that such a proposal in those areas would get planning consent. And with wind, you'd be looking, people say, why don't you put in a lot of small wind turbines that have less of a visual impact? Rule of thumb, if you double the length of a turbine blade, you get four times more energy. So the bigger you go, the greater the marginal returns. Yeah, the considerations around Bath, obviously with the World Heritage setting, the World Heritage site, UNESCO, future landscapes, would make it very challenging around Bath. We have looked at maximising our kind of capacity up on the areas where we have playing fields and near there, but on Lansdowne, for example, but we have an intensification of leisure use, obviously, which is very important. So attention is already kind of going elsewhere. There's an assessment that we've had done to inform our planning documents that looks at where the greatest wind resource is. Obviously, with solar, that can be almost anywhere as long as you can, you're not shaded. But with wind, it's much more varied. And one of those places is Charmey Down, up on the A46, for example. So it probably wouldn't get planning consent with the way the local planning laws are at the moment, because of that landscape-led. But it would be, yeah, an interesting one to test. How visible would it be from Bath? You can have fun with that and look at, there's a website called wewantwind.org where you can place a turbine on the landscape and it gives you a, you know, it generates a fly-around video so you can see what it might look like, which is quite fun. But obviously with those landscape considerations, you would, with an authority area, with a much rural area towards the southwest, then, yeah, it's quite easy to see how there's a temptation to focus elsewhere. But ideally, you want your generation as close to your demand as possible.
So just leaping ahead into further than 2030, maybe 20 years ahead, what would the citizens of Bath see that they don't see now? How will it be different?
It's difficult to say whether, you know, one of those sites that I've mentioned, for example, Charmey Down area, where it's the assessments have suggested that it's a good location for wind, is former Spitfire airfield, so it's quite high up. There's likely to be, you know, the easier place to put wind farms is away from the urban centres, especially in Bath's case. So it may be, and with the change in legislation, we expect to see proposals from commercial developers and, you know, community energy companies start to emerge, because the de facto ban on wind was announced very early on in the Labour government, within the first day or two, I think. So it was extremely difficult for wind farms to get permission onshore since about 2015. So, yeah, you'd probably expect somewhere in the authority area that there might be some wind. It's very difficult to say where.
Okay. Exactly. And solar panels, are we going to see them on Georgian roofs?
I think so. And at the moment, if they're out of sight from the ground, you can get consent for those. And I know there is a lot, you know, there's a big appetite. If you speak to Bath Preservation Trust, a lot of people who live in these large Georgian buildings are eager to do, you know, the right thing in terms of lowering their carbon emissions, trying to make their houses more energy efficient. And so obviously you need to do it in a sensitive way to maintain the character. But I think there's plenty of appetite there. And as people look to decarbonise their homes and move to installing heat pumps and using their own generation to charge their vehicles or power their heating, then that appetite's only going to grow. And I think perhaps the market offer for solutions that are more sensitive, like potentially roof tiles, which at the moment haven't been as efficient as your standard solar panels in terms of the amount they can generate, they'll probably become more into play, hopefully, so that it would be barely noticeable, maybe, that you've got solar capacity on your roof of a Georgian building.
Now, I know that the Roman baths heat the abbey. The excess heat from the Roman baths is used to heat the abbey. I also know that Cleveland Pools is using a river heat pump to transfer heat from the river to the pools. Is there anything else that will happen like that in Bath?
Yes. Well, I mean, there is already for the Roman baths and pump room energy capture in the King's Bath, which provides heat. So there are plates located in the King's Bath and that heat is recovered and provided to the new Claw Learning Centre, which is the redeveloped extension of the Roman Baths and Pump Room complex. And we're looking with our heritage estate colleagues at how we can extend that further to try and get totally off gas, given the amount of available heat there is there. And potentially downstream of that. So, yeah, you mentioned the Abbey. That's slightly downstream of the King's Bath. And it recovers the heat from the Great Drain before it gets into the River Avon. So we've been looking at funding options for further exploring the opportunity to do that for other buildings in the area, such as the Guildhall.
I know one of the issues that people have around solar farms is that it removes, or it may remove habitat, decrease biodiversity, and also remove land for agricultural use. What, you know, there's always tensions and trade-offs in all of this. How does the council respond to that?
I think by laying out good sort of case studies and examples from things that are already being done in that space by the community energy companies in terms of the way the sites are laid out, the requirement for, which we have in our planning at the moment for an increase in biodiversity net gain. I think it's set at a minimum 10%. I know that community energy companies have done independent studies on some of their sites and had a greater increase of 55%. I know locally there was one, and that can obviously depend on what the land was used for before. So, for example, sheep grazing is not good for biodiversity. So if you install a solar farm and there are significant hedgerows provided and spacing between the lines of solar panels, you can increase biodiversity there quite easily. But also you needn't necessarily take it out of agriculture. You can do grazing around solar farms. And in some places, whilst you need a slightly more elevated frame, you can be growing things as well with a different configuration. So, for example, in some places they grow sort of fruits that need sort of partial shading. Raspberries, for example, under sort of solar arrays. So they're growing and generating at the same time.
Are there solar panels on the top of the Civic Centre here?
Yeah, there are. And we're looking at getting funding for getting heat pumps here, so utilising that energy rather than selling it back to the grid, which, you know, at certain times when we're not in the office, it will be doing, to actually use the energy rather than sell it back to the grid is a really good thing to do. So, yeah, the roofs and the community building next door with the library and the community space are covered in solar panels.
We've got the beautiful Weir in Bath. Is there any possibility of hydropower attached to that?
Well, yeah, there is. We've had some preliminary work done to identify what we could theoretically generate there. We think it's a very early look, and there's a lot more work to be done, that it could provide energy for some heat pumps that, say, for example, at the Guildhall. It's roughly about that size. And the Guildhall is a very intensely used building for weddings and functions and filming and offices and records office and the Victoria Arts Gallery. So that would be a significant thing if we could do it. And again, with hydro, river hydro, it is relatively small amounts, but in that location, it could be a very consistent supply of energy, which of course is good through the winter for running your heat pumps and potentially air conditioning in the summer as well.
Thank you so much, Robin, for talking to me today. It's quite a complex technical subject, this, but I think hopefully we've got to the bottom of some of it.
Yeah, thanks very much. No, it's one of my favourite subjects, so it's very exciting. There's a lot of development happening.
Thanks so much to Robin Spalding there. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thank you for joining me. And remember that links to all the items in this episode are in the show notes as usual. Don't forget you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like, and please share as widely as you can with friends, family and colleagues. And for more information on Barscape, visit the website barscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and Players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.